MacCast, Monday, November 12th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me. We've got a few things to talk about in the Mac Apple community this week, although the news seems to be slowing down a little bit. It tends to happen as we get toward the end of the year here, but still some good things to discuss. Also, we have some great feedback and questions from you. A lot of iOS questions this week. We're going to dive into all of that in a moment, but before we get started, I do want to take a quick second and thank one of our show sponsors, and that's Citrix GoToMeeting with HD Faces. You know, so much of how we communicate is expressed through our facial expressions, through our body language, and technology is awesome because it allows us to work from virtually anywhere now. We can collaborate, we can meet electronically, and that's awesome, but email and text and voice calls can sometimes lead to miscommunication. You know, seeing that nod of agreement, raised eyebrow, these kinds of things add nuances to your meetings, and they could be missed in other kinds of electronic communications. And that's why a product like GoToMeeting with HD Faces can be so valuable for your business. You can collaborate with your team, you can see them in HD, so you don't miss any of those little non-verbal communication cues. And you can do things like share your screen. So that means you can show documents and you can get everyone on the same page. And you can also launch and join meetings from anywhere. With a computer, a tablet, a smartphone. As a matter of fact, you can even now present a meeting from your iPad. So totally mobile, great, great tool. I've been using GoToMeeting with my clients, and I particularly love how easy it is to set up a meeting even when the client isn't that technical. You can set up the meeting, send an email with a link. They can even easily add the meeting to their calendar. So with just a click, they've got it all scheduled and set up, and then when it's time to join the meeting, it's just a couple more clicks and they're in. There's no complicated things to install. It just all works. And best of all, for MacCast listeners, you can try it free for 30 days. Just visit gotomeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and be sure to use the promo code MacCast when you sign up, and they'll let you try it out. You can see all of the great features and functionality in GoToMeeting with HD Faces. And a big thank you to Citrix for their support of the MacCast. It's been about a week now since the new iPads hit the streets. They're out in the wild, the fourth generation iPads, as well as the iPad minis, at least the Wi-Fi models. The LTE models are on their way. And Apple did announce that they sold 3 million iPads in the first weekend of sales. That was a number that a lot of analysts had said Apple needed to hit in order to consider the new iPad a success, although they were specifically referring to the iPad mini. I found it very interesting that Apple, when they released their first weekend numbers, lumped the iPad mini in with the fourth generation iPad. They didn't break out the two numbers, although analysts are estimating that about two-thirds of those iPad sales were for the iPad mini. So you're looking at somewhere in the range of 1.5 million to 2 million iPads on the opening weekend. That doesn't match the number of iPads sold in the third generation iPad, which I think was 3 million units, but I think Apple did pretty well. I think they're not going to complain about selling 2 million iPad minis and another 1 million of the fourth generation iPad. It's not a huge change. We're also leading into the holiday sales season, so I think you're going to see a ramp up specifically of iPad mini sales. I think they're going to kind of go trend slowly upward, and it doesn't surprise me that you didn't see a huge hit in the opening weekend. I think also some of the supply constraints factored into some of the sales numbers. But as far as sales, Apple seems to be selling them pretty briskly, even despite the fact that some people felt Apple should have tried to hit that sub $300 price point, coming in at $299. Apple priced the iPad mini at $329 US, we know now, and there may be good reason for that. Apple likes to have a healthy profit margin on the iPad, and IHS, formerly iSupply, did their component cost breakdown, and they estimate that the iPad mini component costs weigh in at about $188 US for the 16 gigabyte model. So you factor that in, you factor in Apple's profit margin that they like to get, and it makes sense that they're at that $329 price point. And I don't think it's going to slow down sales. I think that they're going to do just fine, even against the competitor tablets that are in that sub $200 price point, the $199. And we're already seeing some price drops on the competition, I think, based on the fact that iPad mini is now in the marketplace. So it's going to be interesting to see how holiday sales break out. But I think sales-wise, and more importantly, profit-wise, Apple is going to fare very well in the fourth quarter of the year. The other thing we're seeing now that iPads are in the wild, of course, is some of the performance numbers. The past week saw many websites and blogs putting up their reviews, along with putting the new iPads through their paces, both the fourth generation iPads and the iPad minis. iMore reported that the new A6X processor in the fourth generation iPad seems to still use Apple's 32 nanometer dual core CPU, just like in the iPhone 5, but that it seems to be clocked up quite a bit, running at possibly 1.4 gigahertz, which is going to account for a lot of that CPU improvement. Apple says it's double the CPU speed. They also believe that Apple is using a newer PowerVR SGX 554 MP4 quad-core GPU on the graphics side, and that's really boosting up the graphics performance, at least in their tests. As I've mentioned before, all of this mounts up to some amazing benchmark scores for the new iPad. The iPad third generation, which did have an improved A5X processor, tested out as fast or sometimes slightly slower than the previous generation iPad, the iPad 2, and that was because it had to drive all those extra pixels in that new Retina display. What the A6X overcomes is a lot of that, so now you have extra horsepower that's actually available to the system to be able to use, not just driving those new pixels. And while that does come through on the raw Geekbench benchmark scores, I think what a lot of the reviews are finding is that those big numbers don't necessarily translate into the same exponential day-to-day real-world use improvements. You're going to see things being a little bit snappier, maybe a little bit smoother, but I think for most users, it's not going to end up being that life-changing. So if you're one of those people who maybe feel a little bit jaded that your iPad third generation is a little bit out of date now, it's probably not going to be that big a deal, and you very likely don't have to rush out and get the new iPad. Now, the processor and GPU updates in the fourth generation iPad may make a bigger difference if you're a heavy user of intensive apps, things like gaming, things like image processing, video, those sorts of things. Anywhere where you're going to have to do encoding, you're probably going to see some significant performance boosts. And if you rely on those sorts of things in your iPad for day-to-day usage, then your upgrade may be a little bit more substantial if you choose to take advantage of it. But overall, a nice update to the iPad. I think it's incremental for a lot of users and not anything truly revolutionary, at least on the performance side, at least not yet. Could change once we see software being updated and more stuff come on board. The iPad mini, same sort of deal. It's an incremental improvement over the performance found in the iPad 2. You essentially have the same CPU that's found in the iPad 2 driving the same number of pixels. So on benchmark scores, it's clocking in about the same performance levels as the iPad 2. The display is still 1024 by 768, but it's smaller, 7.9 inches. So it is packing pixel density down a little bit more, moving it from 132 pixels per inch down to 163 pixels per inch. It's not Retina, but the physical size of those pixels being smaller makes it just a little bit crisper. A lot of people had wondered about the display. How's it going to hold up? Personally, I've been using my iPad 2 or my iPad mini, excuse me, now for a week or so, and the screen is quite nice. Yes, it's not matching what I see with the Retina on my iPad 3, but it's very nice, and I do think it's a little bit, just slightly better than the screen on the iPad 2. And performance-wise, I would say it's very comparable. I don't notice any lag. I don't notice any issues in day-to-day usage. And the one thing that's really impressed me about the iPad mini is that although the physical size of the device is a lot smaller, it's a lot lighter than my full-size iPad, I don't notice that big of a difference in terms of the screen when I'm using it in terms of screen resolution. It fits all the stuff that I would normally want to read. The fonts tend to be a little bit smaller, so in a lot of the applications where I can control the font size, I like to bump it up a little bit, but some of that might just be my age. You know, I'm getting a little bit older, your eyesight starts to go a little bit. So overall, though, it doesn't feel like a compromise. It does feel exactly, and it sounds cliche, but it feels exactly like Apple's marketing says it is that it's a full-sized iPad experience in a smaller package. And I've been so far very impressed and very happy with the iPad mini. I do a lot more content creation in terms of writing and taking notes and doing a lot of my research on my iPad these days. So I think I'm going to stick with my full-size one. I do feel like the iPad mini is very much optimized for content consumption. Although, once again, I'll probably prove myself wrong because I said the same thing about the full-size iPad when it came out. And now I'm doing a lot more content creation on that device. The iPad mini may slowly work itself into my workflow. That is, of course, if my wife doesn't abscond with it first, and she probably will. So we may be a two iPad mini family by the end of the holiday season. We'll have to see. Customers are reporting getting shipping notifications on their pre-orders of fourth generation Wi-Fi plus cellular iPads. It's expected that they will be arriving on Friday, November 16th. Apple, I don't think, had given a firm date, but pre-orders do seem to be shipping out. Again, that's for the fourth generation Wi-Fi plus cellular iPads. It is not expected that the iPad mini Wi-Fi plus cellular iPads will be shipping out before November 21st, I think, was the ship date that Apple gave. That's Wednesday. I haven't seen any notifications or any notices of customers who placed pre-orders for those devices getting shipping notifications yet. And if you are in the market for a cellular iPad, AT&T in the U.S. is offering $100 off a new iPad or actually any other tablet if you're willing to sign up for a two-year contract on an LTE data plan. So if you had been considering a new iPad plus cellular device, you might want to consider take a look at what AT&T has to offer. You could save $100. And as far as I know, this is the first time we've seen AT&T subsidizing the price of an iPad. And at least one source had news last week that the iPhone is no longer the top smartphone worldwide. The title in the third quarter, at least, reportedly went to the Samsung Galaxy S3. This is according to numbers from Strategy Analytics. They say in the third quarter, the Galaxy S3 surpassed the iPhone 4S to take the title. According to the report, the S3 sold 18 million units worldwide versus the iPhone 4S's 16.2 million units. But again, these numbers are for the third quarter, and the fourth quarter could likely see a shift back in favor of Apple because of the iPhone 5, which just arrived in September. That's assuming, of course, that Apple can keep up with demand. There's still reports that the iPhone 4S is in short supply. Current shipping times, when I checked this morning on Apple's website, were 2 to 3 weeks, so that is a slight improvement over the 3 to 4 week shipping times we were seeing about a week ago. So Apple catching up, but still not ahead of the curve, I think, on iPhone 5 quantities. Accessory makers found out this past week that if they want to get Apple's seal of approval on their products, that they're going to need to do a little more work. Apple held its annual MFI conference in China and told accessory makers who want to get their accessories certified as made for iPhone, iPad, or iPod that they're going to need to conform to Apple's supplier code of conduct. The code of conduct is something that's posted on Apple's website and covers rules for labor and human rights, health and safety, the environment, and even ethics. Previously, the requirement only applied to Apple's supply chain partners and component vendors, but Apple has changed those rules to include accessory makers. They didn't provide details on exactly how they would be auditing or what, if any, penalties or fines may be imposed for non-compliance. Obviously, they're not going to be able to get the seal if they don't comply with those rules, and I would imagine that would get revoked in cases where suppliers or vendors were found in violation. The new rules are one reason why so far we haven't seen any third-party Lightning accessories, and accessory makers had been waiting to find out the new rules so that they could get Apple's blessing. Didn't take long, though, after announcing those new rules for the first vendor to show up and say that they had Lightning-compatible accessories. That was Belkin, and they almost immediately announced that they had a new car charger and new dock accessory that would support the Lightning connector. So I have a feeling we'll see more vendors coming online pretty quickly as they meet Apple's new requirements. When Apple announced at the iPad mini event that they had done an update to the new iPad, creating the fourth generation iPad, I think some of us were a little bit surprised, and that immediately started a conversation about whether or not Apple was going to continue this trend. For my part, I kind of felt that maybe this is a sign that Apple is not going to be sticking to set release cycles, and that as new technologies become available and that they are able to roll them into their manufacturing processes, that they're just going to go ahead and do that. They're going to start revving products more frequently, especially on the iOS side. Well, this week we saw some rumors that that may be exactly what they're up to. DigiTimes cited a report by the Commercial Times that Apple may be getting set to upgrade the iPhone 5 already, maybe as soon as the first quarter of 2013. Now, when I read this report, I thought that that timing was kind of interesting and lends a little bit of credence to this rumor. Now, both these sources tend to be a little bit on again, off again in terms of the reliability of their Apple rumors, but they occasionally get things right. And if you think about the fact that Apple updated the iPad already, which they normally would upgrade in the first quarter of the new year, they need something to fill that slot. And so maybe an update to the iPhone 5 is exactly what's going to happen. Where this is being sourced from, according to DigiTimes, is that Apple reportedly has already ordered a trial run of 50,000 to 100,000 iPhone, what they're calling 5S models, from suppliers. They also claim that Apple is speeding up their component certification process and that they may be getting ready to do full-scale production of a new iPhone for delivery in the first quarter of 2013. The same sources are also alluding to a potential tweak to the fourth generation iPad screen. Now, that would seem way too close after the original announcement, but the report says that, and I had not heard this before, that some users are reporting a slightly reduced quality of the new Retina panels versus the old ones. I think more on the side of just the overall crispness of the pixels as you kind of zoom in and get really close to this to the display. And I'm not sure if this is related to the new in-cell technology. Apple is using that technology that merges the touch panel and LCD layers together. So maybe the fact that there's not the same process or the same kinds of technology going into the display are lending themselves to this. Although it was reported that the in-plane panels should be actually better quality than the prior Retina because you don't have that little air gap separation between the two things. So maybe they're related, I don't know, but the rumor is that Apple wants to improve the quality of the display just a little bit more. So there wouldn't be anything to prevent them from, if they found a better technology or a different supplier that can supply a better technology display, there wouldn't be anything to prevent them from just sort of sliding that into the production, sourcing from a new component supplier and just rolling that into newer iPads. I don't even know that they would do an announcement to tell anybody that they had changed anything, because Apple does source panels from multiple sources. So depending upon which iPad you get, you could get a different panel. I'm not sure if that's the case in terms of the new fourth generation iPad, but they have historically sourced panels from multiple sources in the past. So don't know about that. There's also no mention of whether or not Apple will update in the same time frame the iPad mini. Some people have speculated that Apple would roll out an update before the year is out of a new Retina display for the iPad mini. That's one of the biggest complaints that have been levied, you know, by detractors against the iPad mini, that it doesn't have a Retina screen, and some of the competitors, some of the other 7-inch tablets out there, are moving to HD, higher pixel density displays. So Apple may want to update the iPad mini at some point to bring their specs in line with that. I don't think that's going to happen right at the beginning of the year, not so soon after Apple just started shipping an iPad mini. But again, all bets may be off. Apple seems to be changing how they're doing things, and we're just going to have to wait and see what happens. Now, not directly Apple related, DigiTimes is also reporting, or also reported last week, that Apple supplier Foxconn may be looking to open up manufacturing plants in the U.S. The report claims that Foxconn has been looking at L.A. and Detroit as possible locations for a new plant, but they also didn't rule out other U.S. cities. They say that the Foxconn chairman said at a recent event that they had begun training U.S.-based engineers, bringing them to China and Taiwan to participate in some of their design and manufacturing, getting them up to speed, and that sort of led to the speculation that they may be looking to open a U.S. factory. It's believed that the U.S. factory would focus on LCD TV production, not specifically for Apple, and so it's not really clear whether or not that would include the new Apple-branded TV set that a lot of people are speculating Apple is working on and may come to become a new product in 2013. And I think it would be feasible that if Foxconn had a new TV factory in the U.S., that Apple would take advantage of it. Apple is not opposed to using U.S. suppliers. As a matter of fact, Tim Cook pointed out in the last quarterly results call that the Corning glass that's used in the iPhone and iOS devices, as well as Apple's own processors, are both manufactured in the U.S., in Kentucky and Texas, respectively. And I think Apple would be open to producing more products at plants in the U.S. if the business opportunity made sense for it. So if Apple is working on a new LCD television and Foxconn has new factories in the U.S., it may all line up to become a reality. We're just going to have to wait and see, but that rumor is out there this week, and I found that rather interesting. I know that at the iPad mini event, the iPad mini and the next generation iPad were sort of the big showstoppers. And of course, Apple announced some new Mac products along with the beautiful new iMacs. But I really think one of the cooler technologies to come out of that announcement is the new Fusion Drive stuff. I'm very interested in that stuff. And I've been very interested to see how the performance numbers stacked up. And this week we got a little glimpse at how the Fusion Drive is actually going to perform. For those of you who don't know, a real quick summary, the Fusion Drive is Apple's merging of solid state storage with traditional, more cost-effective hard disk-based storage, giving you the best of both worlds. And it's a little bit of a different technology from some of the caching technologies that we've seen, the hybrid drives that Seagate does and stuff like that, with just a little bit of flash storage, maybe 8 gigabytes of flash, and then the rest being solid state storage. What Apple has done is they've taken a 128 gigabyte flash drive and married it with a 1 terabyte or 3 terabyte hard drive, and they do it all in OS X in the software, so they create these sort of virtual volumes. And it's really cool stuff. The website TechFast Lunch and Dinner was playing around with a new Mac Mini and one of Apple's Fusion Drives, seeing if it delivers on the performance that Apple is promising. And they took the Mini and compared it to a stock 2012 non-Fusion Drive Mac Mini. So same Mac Mini, basically the only difference was one with a Fusion Drive, one without. And interesting to note that the spindle-based hard drive, the traditional hard drive that was in both models, was a 5400 RPM drive. So not the fastest drive on the planet, but what they discovered was that they were getting read-write speeds that were 3 to 4 times faster on the Fusion Drive than they were on the non-Fusion Drive, and boot times that were twice as fast. So I think it took about 35 seconds for the traditional Mac Mini hard drive to boot up, whereas the Fusion-based one did it in about 15 seconds. So they also looked at moving large files around. They copied, I think, a 4 gigabyte file, and the speed gains on the Fusion Drive were amazing. One of the cool things about the software and the technology in the Fusion Drive is that it always does your writes to the solid state storage, and then in the background, it manages what files you access most frequently, what files and applications you access most frequently, and moves that stuff onto the solid state drive. I believe the OS is also installed onto the solid state portion, which leads to those faster boot times and things. And so definitely an impressive technology. If you're looking to maximize the performance of your new Mac Mini or your iMac, I would seriously consider spending the extra $250 to get the 1 terabyte Fusion Drive add-on. It will well will be well worth the investment, again, for those people who are just looking to maximize performance in terms of launching applications, in terms of boot up times, in terms of doing writes of large files and things like that. And especially if you don't want to spend the money to go all solid state, to go all flash, it can be a little bit expensive, or maybe you need the advantages of the extra storage that a traditional hard drive offers. So I do think it is a nice balance between the two. Still a little bit more on the pricier side. 250 is a significant upgrade for people. I've been so far happy with my traditional spindle drives, but I don't need the added performance. And I know there's a lot of people out there that do. Will I consider a Fusion drive on my next Mac? It's going to be a tough call. I think if I have the few extra dollars to spend, I very likely will spend it just based on the performance numbers that we're seeing. Another area in the future where we may see performance in Macs, desktop-based Macs, would be Apple bringing their own Apple-branded processors into the mix. There is more and more speculation that Apple is going to be working on their own processors for both notebooks and desktop Macs. It's believed that Bob Mansfield's new technologies group is going to oversee the development of future processors for Apple's products. And many analysts believe that Apple will try to work to tweak the AX technology and the ARM-based designs into a chip that they can put into future Mac products to kind of replace the Intel processors that they're using now, or to exactly replace the Intel processors that they're using now. One of the thoughts, and I think this makes a lot of sense, is that with the shared nature of the operating system, OS X and iOS sharing a lot of the core functionalities and technologies, and that seems to be integrating more in the future, that having a single unified chip architecture would also help further unify Apple's platforms moving forward. And it may be a while before we actually see Apple-branded chips in Macs, but I think it does make a lot of sense that that eventually could happen. I also personally think, though, that Apple's chip designers and the talent that they've acquired over the years could potentially develop an x86-compatible branded Apple chip to replace the Intel processors. And couldn't that happen a little bit sooner than sort of moving the ARM technology? ARM processors tend to be thought more as mobile processors, as lower power processors. I don't know that they can be tweaked up to become desktop systems, but I don't know a lot about that chip technology. I'm just sort of speculating and thinking off the cuff here. So I don't know if some of you know more about chip technologies, more about the ARM-based technologies. Are they viable for desktop processors? Can Apple, with the incredible design teams and chip designers that they have on staff under the leadership of Bob Mansfield, can they push ARM into a true desktop processor? I think it's sort of been tried before, at least on the notebook side, and hasn't really taken off as yet. But maybe Apple's the company to do it. But I also do think, couldn't they just also develop some of their own x86-based designs, and couldn't they move into those as replacement for the Intel chips? Either way, I think for sure Apple is up to something on the processor side. They've shown and proven with iOS devices that they can make some amazing chips, design some amazing chips, and get them manufactured. And so I'm very excited to see what happens moving forward with Apple's processors. And on the operating system side, it does look like Apple is looking to make true on its promise of releasing a new version of OS X every year. Several sources this week cited seeing copies of OS X 10.9 show up in their website access logs. Starting as early as September, different sites said that they saw in their statistics a new version of OS X. It's very likely that it's Apple doing some internal testing of the new version of the operating system, although those entries can be spoofed. I don't think that that's what's going on here. I do think that Apple is starting to make ready versions of OS 10.9, and very likely we're going to be seeing them put out betas into the hands of developers so they can start working on that, you know, with a summer release of the new version of the operating system coming out. The timing seems to make sense. And then finally, one little interesting thing. So in the same week that we saw announcements of 10.9 kind of making its appearance, there was also a report from Net Applications about which version of OS X is currently the most popular. And Mountain Lion has seen an incredible uptake and really fast adoption rate for a new version of the operating system. As a matter of fact, in October, 25% of all Macs were reportedly running Mountain lion. Leopard currently accounts for about 10% of Macs, according to the study. But most interesting is that lion and snow leopard are actually tied for the most used version of OS X, tied at 30%. So a lot of people sticking with lion, a lot of people still sticking with snow leopard, a lot of us wishing we had stuck with snow leopard, those of us who were on lion and ran into troubles. I think that mountain lion is a really great operating system. I think that it's worth moving up to if you're on lion or if you're on snow leopard. So I think we'll see the mountain lion number going up much more quickly as snow leopard and lion people upgrade, but they seem to be taking a little bit of time before deciding whether or not they want to make the leap. And of course, Snow Leopard was the last version of the operating system that would run on 32-bit. So if you have an older Mac, you're kind of sticking very likely with Snow Leopard. And that may be where some of these higher numbers are coming from as well. But very interesting that operating system moving several generations forward, but maybe not everybody moving along at the same pace or as quickly as Apple would probably like to see them doing it. Apple certainly tries to give us reasons to upgrade for sure, and it'll be interesting to see what shows up in 10.9 to make us want to move from Mountain Lion. But with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, it's Notebook is an awesome application for taking notes and for organizing all sorts of things. It really, though, takes those tasks to the next level with all of the extra things that are built into the application that sort of let you go beyond just the notes and the organizational tools. Those are great, but you have things in there like drawing tools. So you can create diagrams, you can annotate things with all kinds of shapes and draw boxes and really create elaborate diagrams if that's what you need to do. You can also, you know, draw things just with a tablet. If you have, you can do it on your trackpad, you can do it with a Wacom tablet, something like that. They have voice annotation tools in there, so you can record audio and get markers so that you can go back if you need to review a lecture or something like that. If you're a student, that's really, really handy. Flags and sticky notes are in there, so you can add additional notations, flag things, come back, review them later. If you clip in information from outside sources or drag in information from outside sources, say your contacts or your calendar, or you use a web clipping, you get these great little stickers in the margin that allow you to link back to that information or actually access that information contextually right from within the application. So it's cool. You throw a contact in there and you can get to that contact information without even having to open up address book. You just click on the little icon in the margin and away you go. So it's powerful tools like that that make it a really useful tool. And then you have all of that rolled up with the multi-dex indexing that makes browsing, searching, and finding that information really easy. And in addition, they have an iPad version so you can sync and take your documents with you. It's just a really great application, so you should check it out. Also, while you're over on their website, you should also check out their new iTrash application. That lets you take your trash icon out of the dock and put it back on the desktop where it belongs, right? Those of us who are old school, we had the trash on the desktop, and one of the advantages of that is the trash doesn't move around. You know, as things go in and out of the dock, you lose that muscle memory of where the trash is. And not only that, with the iTrash application, you can get these cool animations and sound effects, and they actually make it fun. They put fun back into your Mac. Again, like we did in the old days, we used to be able to customize things and we could do things with the trash icons and we could use ResEdit and all that fun stuff. It brings back a lot of that nostalgia. So Circus Ponies, they make great applications. You should check out Notebook. You should check out iTrash. You can get more information and details as well as free trials over at circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I'm not really sure what was going on the last episode of the MacCast, but, you know, I try and make sure that I have as few errors and fumbles and foibles as possible, but for some reason, I think I was just a little bit off on that last episode. And probably my biggest error that I need to point out, and a lot of you noticed this, I'm assuming some of you maybe didn't notice this, maybe you had the same hang-up that I had, but apparently I had a huge reality distortion field set up around myself with respect to iPads and headphones, because I said that I was disappointed that the iPad mini did not ship with any headphones, and many people wrote to point out, and very accurately I may add, that the iPads have never shipped with headphones. Somehow, I had thoroughly convinced myself that they had headphones with them. Just Apple's earbuds, you know, the $20 little cheap earbuds. Nope, they were never in there. I think Apple should. So I'm just going to amend my thing and just say, I think Apple should be shipping headphones with every iPad. And why they haven't to date, I think, is a big omission. And I still think it's very cheap on Apple's part. Probably makes it cost them a few bucks to make the headphones. You're paying a lot for that product. It's not going to eat that much from the profit margin. Apple, come on. Just give us some headphones with our iPads. And especially those new cool EarPods. They want to get those out to as many people as they possibly can. Huh? I guess they want to sell them to as many people as they possibly can. That's probably the reality. So who am I to say? They probably make a lot of profit off that stuff. Apple, keep doing what you're doing. Keep the stock price up. Keep the investors happy. Is there a dichotomy between those two things? I think maybe there is. I think there's actually a dichotomy between my own feelings about Apple is what the reality is. As a customer, I want to get everything for nothing, just like all of us do. But as an Apple watcher, I want the company to do well as well. So I guess balancing those two things is something I'll just best leave to Apple. I guess they know what they're doing. A couple other things that I got wrong. I somehow mixed up the iOS 6.1 beta features. That's something that was released to developers and is coming out, I would assume, sometime in the near future, with a lot of the features that were in the iOS 6.0.1 update. I guess when I was taking my notes, I somehow missed one of the reports that was reporting on 6.1 features versus 6.0.1 features. And I told everybody about a new lock screen music player user interface and also a larger report a problem button that is appearing in Maps. Both of those features are iOS 6.1 features, not 6.0.1 features. So if you've been looking for those on your device and wondering where they were, just like I was, that's why you're not seeing them. And then the last thing, I think this is a minor one, and I've probably done it more than once on more than one episode. I somehow mixed up the term lightning connector with Thunderbolt. I think I said that the new iPad mini had a Thunderbolt connector, and of course it has a lightning connector, not a Thunderbolt connector. So on any of those things, sorry for the confusion, and hopefully that clears things up. On the last episode, I also discussed some of Steve Ballmer's recent comments with relation to the tablet market and how he felt the Surface was fitting in. That basically, Ballmer had commented that no one has really done a tablet that was out there for actually getting work done, work in terms of meaning like business work being done. And of course, specifically, he was referring to tablets running Microsoft Office software, that, you know, businesses rely on Office, and the Surface is a tablet that is going to give you that full Office Windows experience in a tablet, and that nobody else other than Microsoft was delivering that. And I basically argued that I really felt that in the tablet space, not doing quote unquote real work or business on tablet devices was really a limitation of the consumer, of the users. And I pointed to the fact that there's a lot of art and music and a lot of content creation being done on tablets. Now that people are sort of discovering what they are and how to use them, we just haven't really seen a lot of people replacing their business uses of notebooks or desktop computers with tablets yet. And I feel that it's something that is just, we need to change our workflows. We need to change how we expect to interact with these devices. Instead of trying to make the devices, which I think is a little bit of what Microsoft is doing, trying to turn the tablet into some sort of hybrid PC device, letting the tablet do what it does best and be a tablet and perform as a tablet, and adjusting the software and adjusting our workflows and just our overall thinking about how we do work and how we approach the device into a new place. In other words, learning to use the new technology. It's sort of like a great analogy would be when the mouse came out and when graphic user interfaces came out, we had to change how we did work. And I think that's going to happen with tablets. I think it already is naturally happening with tablets. There's just this learning curve. And I think traditional PC users are just having to kind of get by, and they're not really using tablets to their fullest potential. I think with new users who grow up with tablets, they're going to inherently overcome some of those challenges. Those of us who are traditional desktop and laptop PC users have to learn that stuff. And are we willing to do it, or are we going to try and force our tablet devices into the old paradigm? And I had said that I felt really that Apple's approach of approaching this as a new device and a new platform is the better way to go. I think in the long run, doing what Microsoft is doing with the Surface is going to appease a small segment of the market, but that's not necessarily the future. That's not where the platform needs to be moving. And so that was a little bit of my perspectives and my thoughts on it. But when it comes down to getting business done, I've also had a few conversations that are like, and comments that are like this one from Illyrio.
Hi, Adam. It's Illyrio. It's my first time sending in feedback. I'm a self-employed software trainer in Montreal, Canada. And by the way, you are the first podcast I ever listened to back in 2006, and I'm still listening to you now. Enjoy the show. Love it. Just paused your latest episode after you talked about what Steve Ballmer was talking about, criticizing the iPad and talking about not being ready for work and that such. Now, I have some counterpoints, but not in defense of Steve Ballmer's stance, but more to kind of let you in on what is a real obstacle for people who love Office and why the iPad isn't ready for them, and why as soon as Microsoft Office is available on the iPad, people like myself and others are going to be very happy. And here's the thing. Although word processing, which is a very kind of widespread term, a very large umbrella term, is available on the iPad in many forms, and I myself have an iPad too. I love it. I use it more than my laptop. The only thing I use my MacBook for now is podcast recording and editing. If GarageBand didn't have a limit on the number of minutes you could have on a track, I'd be doing that there as well. But regardless, as someone who trains people how to use Office software and other software at work and in some training centers, all my clients are professionals. They use the software for work and at work. And we can't discount some of the very important features that Microsoft Office does provide the consumer. And just Word alone, track changes is one of the most important features that it offers, that if it weren't for that, you'd see a lot more people using Pages. I myself have Pages on the iPad. I use it every once in a while, but when I have to make sure that a document when I have to make sure that a document that's being modified, those modifications are being tracked, I can't use Pages for that. And when I go to where people work and people come to where I work and I teach them, you know, an intermediate or advanced Word course, we're all in the higher end features of Word, like track changes, like a table of contents and indexing. And there's a lot of stuff that the average consumer just doesn't realize is actually available in Microsoft Office. And a lot of those features are incredibly important in the enterprise. So although you can do a lot with the iPad, I myself do my invoicing with FileMaker Go. I use it all the time as if it was an actual computer. When I need to do my quarterly reports, I'm using Excel on my MacBook because Numbers is not capable of doing everything that I need it to do, that Excel already does. Conditional formatting, things like nested if functions that actually have pull-down menus available, and lots of the intricate customizability that you can actually do in Office without even knowing Visual Basic or any of that stuff that I don't even touch. Lots of what you do in Office is so critical to workflow that even if Numbers and Pages weren't around, I mean, there are no other alternatives. And I don't think it's so much a let's change the way we look at how we use computers. It's what is the task that needs to be done? Does this tool give me a solution for getting the task done? And right now, if I were to compare Word and Excel to Pages and Numbers respectively, frankly, it's not there yet, not by a long shot. That's why I'm going to be extraordinarily happy once Office is available for the iPad. Anyway, love the show. Hope I didn't ramble on. Thank you.
No, you didn't ramble on at all. And I think those are very valid and very good points. And I see what you're saying. And I think we're in some ways kind of getting to the same position. I was approaching it from if we can kind of rethink how we do things or rethink how we do our workflows to fit better fit a tablet workflow, then we can get a lot more work done on the iPad. And I still think that's true. I think you also point out the other problem, though, is that there are software limitations in certain segments, in certain areas. And I think that's a little bit of what Ballmer was alluding to. I think where you may agree with me, and I couldn't really tell from that comment, but where you may agree with me is that the answer is not moving the tablet and trying to push it back into a desktop platform or to get the PC version of Word or Office running on a tablet. I think what we need is we need a tablet-optimized version of Word or Office that has the features and functionality that consumers need to get work done and meet that workflow need. And the workflow may need to change a little bit. And I think for sure the user interface and how you interact with that application needs to change for the platform. And I think that's what Microsoft and what Ballmer doesn't get. And that's why I think on the tablet side of things, that's where they're ultimately going to miss the boat and where consumers and even consumers in the enterprise aren't going to respond. Because if you try and use Office on the Surface tablet, which I had the opportunity to do, it feels very awkward and clunky and kludgy. So maybe all the features and functionality are there, but I'm not sure that the workflow is optimized in the way that it needs to be for that style of device. And I think that's where Microsoft is making a misstep on the desktop as well, because they're trying to shoehorn the touch user interface and things into the desktop metaphor. And I think that's another area where that doesn't work. And I think it's also a reason why we haven't seen Apple do a touch-based Mac yet. I think when it makes sense and when they've worked out some of the workflow and the UI stuff, that's when we'll see it. But they're certainly not going to try and shoehorn a tablet interface onto the desktop. And so I think ultimately we are going to get there. It's interesting, you mentioned that getting Office on iOS devices is something you're looking forward to. This week, Microsoft announced, or at least The Verge, I think, announced that Microsoft is going to be bringing a mobile version of Office to iOS and to Android. And I'll let everybody in the audience know that Ilario and I already went back and forth on this. And unfortunately, the version of Office that's coming to iOS is not what he's envisioning, nor is it what I think most of us would envision. It's going to require an Office 365 subscription, which is free. And so that's not going to be a big deal. I think the apps themselves are going to be free in terms of being able to open up documents and read them. If you want to do editing, you do need to have a paid subscription. But I think the more disappointing aspect of the announcement was the fact that the editing features are going to be limited. And it's my understanding that track changes is not one of those features that's going to be available in those mobile editions, at least not at first. And so that doesn't make it very viable for the enterprise. And I don't know if that's deliberate on Microsoft's part because they want to push customers to the Surface tablets as the Office on a tablet solution, and they're just deliberately keeping that out of iOS or Android. Or what I hope is more the case is that the same reasons why track changes isn't in Pages on the iPad is that it needs to be sort of rethought, that feature needs to be redone in terms of how does it work on a tablet. I don't know what the limitation is. It seems like it would be a simple feature to implement, but obviously nobody's really done it well. I was able to run across at least one application on iOS, Office Squared HD from Byte Squared, that does have, I think, limited support for track changes. They say it'll track textual changes and inserts and deletes. And so I'm not a big Office user, so I don't know exactly what that means. If anybody does use that application, let us know how fully implemented the track changes features are, because that may be a viable solution for someone looking for an Office product on iOS that can do track changes. But I think it's just going to take a little bit more time, that as more people move to tablets as their primary platform, we're going to see more and new innovative solutions that sort of rise to meet some of these current technical limitations. But I still feel that we're in the early stages of this, and there is some mental blocks to people moving to tablets as their primary platform for getting work done. And I think naturally things are going to progress, and we're going to get over those over time in terms of retraining ourselves on these new devices, or those people who are growing up with these devices are just going to naturally migrate into sort of that platform and that way of getting work done. So I think the short answer is that Apple needs to get track changes into Pages. If I were them and listening to this, I'd be like, that's the number one feature we need to get in there to further grab a foothold in the enterprise. And I think Apple would be primed and set to do it very well. Why it's not in there on the iPad yet baffles me, but there's no doubt in talking to you, Alario, and also David Sparks, the night we went to check out that Surface tablet, he's a lawyer, he works in the legal field, and they need track changes on their stuff. And a bunch of his colleagues, he said, are going to be very happy that a device like Surface will be able to open up their documents, their Word documents, and be able to have track changes. And he said a lot of them will buy that product just for that one feature alone. So it's, that says to me that Apple needs to get on the ball and implement this as a feature in their Office suite as well. But I think they've just been more consumer focused. But as more and more tablets make their way and more iPads specifically make their way into enterprise, hopefully Apple takes notice of that and rises to the challenge to provide the features to these customers that they need in those products and delivers them. So I think you'd like to see that, and I certainly would say that I'd like to see that as well. The more and more iPads we can see in more and more places meeting more and more needs, I think pushes the whole platform forward for all of us. If you happen to follow me on Twitter, you may have noticed a disturbance in the MacCast Twitterverse this week. I announced that I had finally cut the cord. Is that the way to put it? Basically, given up, dropped my grandfathered in AT&T unlimited data this past week. Yes, I know it's quite shocking. Some of you are just hearing this for the first time. Why, Adam? Why was the tweets that I received? I got a ton of tweets. Why? What did you make that decision? It seems to a lot of people to be an irrational one, and maybe it is. Maybe it's something I will regret someday. But I thought at the very least I could lay out my thinking and maybe get some of you on my side. I don't know. I don't know if there's a side to be on here. It's just, yeah, we're getting hosed by these guys in terms of data. But this is why I went ahead and finally said, you know what, I'm going to let go of my grandfathered in unlimited data on AT&T. And what it comes down to is occasionally I need to be able to tether my iPad. I don't have 3G iPads. My original iPad that I purchased was a 3G one. I didn't use the 3G functions all that frequently. So as I've purchased new iPads and upgraded, I've been going with Wi-Fi only models. But every once in a while with my business, with what I do, I need to be able to get online where I don't have access to Wi-Fi. And so my solution to date, and I've talked about this on the show a couple years ago, I purchased a pay-as-you-go phone from Radio Shack, LG Optimus V phone, and I use a $25 a month unlimited everything plan, so I get unlimited phone, text, and data, although I only really use the data on Virgin Mobile, and which is the Sprint network here in the US. And so I've been using that in a pinch as my sort of Wi-Fi tethering hotspot. And when I first got it, typical data speeds, it's not the fastest in the world. It's Sprint's 3G network, so I would get data speeds in the 2 to 3 megabit per second range. It wasn't great, but it was cheap. There was no contract. It was unlimited, so I dealt with it. It worked for what I needed to do, checking email, surfing the web, getting access to information. Now, recently, though, and I know they've gone through some changes in terms of their network. I'm not sure exactly everything that's going on behind the scenes, and this is actually part of the problem, is that they don't communicate very well because they're mobile virtual network operator, MVNO, for Sprint. Virgin Mobile doesn't, you know, really let me know what's going on all that much. But recently, I was getting really horrible data speeds when I would enable the feature. And again, I don't use it that frequently, so I don't notice it that often. But every time I would go to turn it on, I'd get like 500 kilobits per second on my download. The speeds were so bad that it was completely unusable. So I was paying basically $25 a month to get nothing. And I've been going back and forth with their tech support for 2 months, powering off the phone, having them reset things on the network. Nothing was seeming to work. They were incredibly rude, actually, a couple times when I called tech support. And not only that, the tech support wasn't even in the US. And I usually don't get hung up on that, but in this case, there were several times where I couldn't understand the person on the phone. I think they were misunderstanding me. It was just all around a terrible experience. So occasionally I need this tethering option. I've been paying $25 a month for it. I had been mulling over switching over to an AT&T plan, a data pro plan, where I could actually use the AT&T tethering for a while. And now that I have the iPhone 5, the LTE speeds are incredible. I was even more seriously considering it. So between that and between the fact that I couldn't even use the tethered connection I was paying for, I really started to, again last week, look into the 5 gigabyte data pro plan, which for tethering and my data would end up costing me $50 US per month. My current solution was to pay $30 a month for my iPhone data through AT&T, and that was the unlimited grandfathered plan. That was the rate that I got it at. And then I was paying $25 a month on top of that for this hotspot access. I looked into pure hotspot solutions, you know, getting one of the little MiFis or similar style device on a 4G network through Sprint, through AT&T. I was looking at anybody who could give me a good deal, but they all seemed to break out at about $50 a month for a 2-year contract. And of course, that would be the $50 a month on top of the data plan I was already paying for my iPhone. So I already had data with my iPhone. I really didn't want another contract. And so at that point, I said, you know, let me go back and look at my data usage over the last 3 years. What have I been using on AT&T? And if I was on a data pro plan, how often would I be going over? And when I reviewed it, it would have been 3 times in 3 years where I exceeded the 3 gigabyte data plan. So had I been on that plan the whole time, rather than keeping my grandfathered in data plan, I would have actually saved $140 over the 3 years. So at this point, it's sort of like, what am I holding on to that data plan for? Well, it's always been in the event that someday I start exponentially using a lot more data. I don't have to worry about it, I'll have it. But even at that point, they're going to start data throttling me to the point where that connection becomes unusable. So really, I just stopped seeing the value in it, and I really needed to get a tethering plan. So with the 5 gigabyte data pro plan with tethering, I actually end up saving $5 a month because I'm paying $20 to tether versus $25 to tether. And not only that, I get amazing speeds with my iPhone 5. I'm getting 20 to 30 megabit per second connectivity most of the places that I go. So it's a much more usable connection. I can actually use it to get work done when I need to get done. And a lot of people were wondering, you know, AT&T announced this week that you can now do FaceTime over cellular with their Data Plus plans if you have an LTE phone. So that means if you have an iPhone 5, they're going to let you in on that plan. Unfortunately, they're still not allowing it for older iPhones. I don't know why they're such sticklers about that, but it doesn't require that you get the family share plans anymore. So that turns out to be a bonus for me, but really doesn't factor into my decision because I don't really use FaceTime all that frequently, and I would probably never use it over cellular. But the fact that I can now, that's a nice little bonus. And so I did all this. I announced it on Twitter. I did have one listener, Mustafa, point out that he has a cool solution that I may have considered in hindsight with all this, but I really don't think it's going to work for me. But I wanted to mention it because it might work for a number of you. And he says that he currently uses a Nexus One phone that he bought outright, unlocked, off contract. I think you can get them for around $200 US now. And that's the original Google Nexus phone. And with that, you can swap out the SIM card in your iPhone. I think it's a micro SIM and not the new nano SIM. So if you have an iPhone 5, you'd have to get the little tray adapter. But you can swap your SIM out if you have a matching SIM. Take the one that has your iPhone grandfathered unlimited data plan in it, pop that into the Nexus One, and it has tethering support out of the box. So you wouldn't be paying any additional. You'd just be using your standard $30 a month grandfathered in plan. Now, it only supports 3G networks and I think HSPA, not even HSPA Plus. So I think your maximum data connection speed is 7.2 megabits. So it's not going to be the fast LTE, but a cheaper solution, and you don't have to give up your grandfathered unlimited plan. So that might be something people want to consider. But I ended up just going to the Data Pro plan. And so far now, just a few days into it, I've been very happy. I've used it a couple times. It works great. It's no hassle. It's no muss. It's no fuss. I don't have to carry around an extra device. So I'm happy so far. When I start going over my data plan, I may be very, very unhappy. But again, it's just $10 more for another gigabyte of data. So I think in the few instances where I'm going to need a little bit more, in the long run, I'm going to end up paying less than I would have. I still think it's way too expensive. I think I'm getting gouged like you wouldn't believe, but we all get that. And it doesn't seem to matter which carrier you're with. So that's why I ended up with not having grandfathered unlimited. Is it right, the right decision for everybody? No, but in my case, I think it was the right choice. Now, if you are considering switching away from an iPhone, maybe permanently, something to like one of the new Nexus phones or a Galaxy S3 or something like that, Christian sent me an email and he ran into a particularly sticky problem related to iMessages and moving from an iPhone to a Nexus phone. He actually was originally on a Nexus phone, moved to the iPhone, and had started using iMessaging, and that was great for all of his friends and family who were using iOS devices. He also has a couple of other iOS devices, iPad, and exchanges text messages and iMessages with those friends and family. And so it was great to be able to send iMessages and save on the SMSing. And everything was going great, but he recently decided to move back to his Nexus phone. And that's when things got a little bit hairy, because he would receive SMS messages from those family members, but very often they would be sending him iMessages. And they would show up on his other iOS devices, but he didn't always have those with him, and he was ending up missing messages because they weren't coming through as SMS text messages on his Nexus phone. So the question was, what can he do? What can Christian do in this situation? And I think there's sort of two things that you're going to want to check, Christian. One, I would say make sure that your friends and family are sending messages from their iDevices that start with a brand new message. Don't use the history that's already in there, because one of the great things about the messaging app on iOS, right, is that it keeps this history. But if that's already set to be in iMessage and they just continue to reply to that message, it's going to keep going to your iMessage account. So I think they need to start a new chat with you. And when they start that, make sure that they use your phone number and not your email address to send you that message. That's going to force it into SMS mode and not iMessage mode. And they should be able to tell that, because the text message or the message that they're sending you on their iOS device will be in green and not in blue. And if you do that, then you should get that message on your phone. The other thing that you're probably going to want to make sure that you do is that you deregister your old iPhone from the iMessage system. And I found this on this information online. I think TechCrunch had an article about it. I do know that, Christian, you said you tried this already and it didn't really work for you, but I want to throw it out there in case somebody else has run into this problem, because it seemed to have mixed reports. And this is good too if you've lost your iOS device, or if it's been stolen, you might want to follow this procedure. So what you do is you unregister the device with Apple. You do it by going into Settings, Messages on the iPhone, if you have it. So this would be in the situation where you were just selling it or getting rid of it, or maybe you weren't going to use it anymore, you were moving to a new device. So go into Messages on the iPhone and make sure that you turn off iMessage. Even if you can't do that, though, you want to then visit Apple's support website and you want to go to your support profile. So it's supportprofile.apple.com. You go there, you log in, and that's going to show you the list of all of the products that you have registered with Apple. Usually when you set up your iPhone, it'll ask you to register it. So you register the device with Apple. If you purchase through the website, I think it actually registers your devices automatically when you make your purchase. So you'll see your products in there. You're going to click on the Edit Products button. And then you're going to click the little X next to the iOS device that you want to remove from Apple's system. And then go ahead and click unregister. Again, this is going to unregister the product with Apple. I would assume if you went back and started using that product again, you could go in and re-register it. And probably if you've had an iOS device stolen or lost, you don't want to unregister the product until you're certain that there's no chance that you're actually going to recover it. Because this is the registration that Apple uses if you go in to get support at the Genius Bar and they want to look up your product and your history and stuff like that. That's what's tied to it. So you really only do this if you're no longer going to use the device anymore, if you're going to sell it, if it's lost, or if it's stolen. But that would be the second step to try out, Christian, and see if those two things don't work. But I think in your case, really what's happening is your family members are sending to that chat history, and it's going to your email address that's registered with iMessage and not to the phone number that's on your new Nexus phone. So give that a shot and let us know how that turns out. Michael emailed me this week, and he has something that I think can be very confusing to a lot of people if you don't kind of understand how the different media player applications work on iOS, and more specifically, how they relate to iTunes on your Mac or your PC. And what this relates to is playlists. Michael uses playlists to sync video onto his iOS devices. And you create those playlists, of course, in iTunes, and you can put movies or TV shows or music or podcasts or whatever you want into a playlist. And that used to be great when in iTunes you would create a playlist and then you synced it over to your iOS device, your iPod, and everything went into the iPod app, which in essence worked like iTunes, but on your iOS device. So you would go in there and there would be your video, there would be your playlists, you'd access everything from there. But you know that recently Apple's been separating things out on iOS, and they've been taking specific types of media, music, a movie, a TV show, a podcast, and they've been funneling that into separate applications for playback on your iOS device. So you now have the music app, you have the video app, and you have the podcast app. So depending upon what type of media you're accessing, you need to go to each one of those individual apps. Well, Michael has these playlists, and the trouble he was having was that after syncing, the playlist would show up in the music app on his iOS device, but would have no items listed in it. And even though there are no items listed in the playlist, you could definitely see that the videos synced over to the iOS device because they would eat up space. If you go under settings, general, under usage in the device, you can see, yes, everything synced over and it's using up space. Also in iTunes, you could see that in the devices section. And so, Michael, as you've noticed, the dilemma is that the music app still sees the playlist. And I think the reason is it goes back to the old days where you can mix and match all kinds of media content into your playlist. It's not just a playlist for music. And so the sync happens and everything moves over, but the destination on the iPad or iPod or iOS device has changed. So your videos are ending up not in the music application, but in the videos application where you would expect them to be. The problem is it leaves that little stub of the playlist behind, and that still shows up in the music app. So you can't see your videos in there, and there's a big disconnect there. And I think this is a big problem for Apple. They've really kind of created this confusion for users. Really, that playlist either shouldn't sync over at all, or there should at least be some sort of pointer or some sort of indicator that there's videos related to that that launch the video application. I don't know the best way to handle it, but certainly it's a problem, and I can certainly understand why you would be confused by this. And there's even an exception to this rule, and that is music videos. If you have music videos in iTunes and you sync those over to your iOS device, those do stay in the music app with pointers to the video application. There's actually a music video section in the video application. And see how all of this gets confusing? Apple really, they've started to separate these things, but it seems like they really haven't thought the whole process through. So what I did discover for you, Michael, is there's a little trick that you could do. If you do want to see your videos in the music app, you can take advantage of this little exception, and you can actually go into the metadata of your video files and just change their kind from being movie to being music videos. So what you do is you go into iTunes, you select the video that you want to change, you go into the file menu, choose Get Info, and then you can edit the setting under the Options tab to change the media kind from video or movie, I can't remember specifically what it says, but change it to music video. And then click OK, and then sync your device. And that way, all the videos that you've placed into your playlist will continue to show up in the music app. They will also show up in the video application, although they will be moved into the music video section. So don't be thrown off by that. That may be more annoying than just having your videos not show up in the playlist in the music app. I don't know. You're going to have to decide on that one. But that's what's going on, and that's why it seems like you're losing your videos, even though they are actually syncing over to your device. And then finally today, I have some iOS device syncing woes of a different kind. I actually have two MacCast listeners with exactly opposite problems related to syncing their applications to their devices. Mark has a situation where he'll delete an app on his device only to have it resync back to the device next time he connects to iTunes. So on the device, he's clicking and holding, getting the little wiggle icons, clicking the X button that closes or deletes the application from his device. And then he goes to sync with iTunes, and lo and behold, the application comes back. The other listener will mark an application to sync to their device in iTunes only to have it later remove itself. I'm not specifically sure on this second one why exactly that's happening, although I do have a couple theories. Actually, I'm not really 100% certain on either of these. I've run into similar kind of funkiness, but never really had consistent problems with adding or deleting applications on my iOS devices. So I'm going to throw out a couple things for you guys to consider checking. But if anybody has some recommendations, I'm kind of leaving this one up to the MacCast community to kind of help solve, because I think there can be a lot of causes for this, and I'm just going to throw out some general answers, and hopefully one of these will work for you. Maybe somebody has a more specific, more direct answer to some of these problems. But couple of things that I would check is in iTunes, I would go in and, you know, connect your device, select the device in iTunes, and go to the summary tab and check the sync settings for syncing the device over Wi-Fi and see if you have it syncing over Wi-Fi. It may be a case where you're making a change, you're syncing through the cable, and then it's coming back later and doing the sync over Wi-Fi. Or in the case of deleting an application, maybe you're deleting that application, it's syncing over Wi-Fi, and it's doing something funky at that point. Although I have a feeling, Mark, in your case, what's happening is something else. I think you are going to want to go into iTunes after deleting the application off your device, select the device, and then go to the Applications tab, and then you're going to want to double check and make sure that the app is unchecked for syncing on your in iTunes on your Mac. It may be a case where you're deleting it from the device itself, and somehow that setting is not syncing back over to iTunes. The application is still checked, so the next time you sync over a cable, or maybe even as you sync over Wi-Fi again, it's pushing that application back onto your device. The other thing you may want to check from that same screen, the Apps tab under the device, is to make sure that the automatically sync new apps option is set the way you want it. So under your applications list, there's a little setting for that. And if you have that checked on, that means anytime you add a new application, purchase a new application, it ends up in your apps list, it's automatically going to check that on for syncing to your device the next time that you do a sync. And so you may be running afoul of that setting as well. The last thing that I would check is on the device itself. I would go into the settings. I would go into the iTunes and App Store settings and check how you have the automatic downloads set up. If apps is checked on, that means that any new app purchases made anywhere, so if you make a new app purchase on another iOS device or you make another new app purchase on your Mac through iTunes, that application is automatically going to sync to that device. So that may be one of the reasons why you're seeing applications end up back on your device when you thought you had deleted them. So check all of those settings. Barring that, there may be some other things going on. There always is the universal solution of doing a backup and restore of your device if it's just acting funky, and that may be a solution in this instance. I don't know. I also read some people who said, specifically in the case of deleting applications and having them show backup on their device, they actually go into the iTunes folder, into the mobile applications folder, and make sure that the IPA file is actually thrown away, trashed, deleted, and removed. Sometimes it looks like that's sticking in there, it's not getting removed, and then that's causing it to end up back on your device. Now, keep in mind there, if you do that, you're going to have to re-download the application if you want to get it back, you know, from your purchased applications. Not a huge deal, but most of us prefer, if you're like me, to just uncheck the application, not have it sync, but have it remain on your Mac in case you ever want to put it back on your device through a cable sync. So those are some things you can try, some settings you can look at, and I'm sure some members of the MacCast community will offer up some additional suggestions as well, and I'll share those on hopefully the next episode. And with that, though, that's going to do it for this show. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of our show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Be sure to check out their software, get more information and details, as well as free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label for the Mac, also Text Expander Touch, and PDF Pen for the iPhone and iPad. You can get more information on all of their software, as well as free trials of the Mac applications, over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, the fast, simple way to sell your used iPhone, iPad, MacBooks, and other smartphones. Find out what your gadget is worth at gazelle.com. And Citrix, check out GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Just visit GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button. You can try it free for 30 days, and be sure to put in the code MACCAST to get your free trial. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9. Leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. That'll do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.